Hi guys, and welcome to Life in the Peloton. I'm Mitch Stocker, and I'll be flying solo this week on the intro. My sidekick Lionel Burney is not here. He's still trying to get his way back from the Tour de France at this moment after a pretty hectic 3 weeks there. But what I do have for you is a fantastic episode lined up. What I've got coming up for you is Juanma Garate. He's from Spain. He's from the Basque Country. He is one of my favorite directors, sports directors that is. I know I've spoken to Tom Southam about sports directing, but what I thought I'd do with Juanma was just go that step further, because I love what he does, the way he directs. It's not just the logistics side of things, but he really gets inside the heads of the cyclists, the riders, the guys in our team. Well, especially me, and I know Mike Woods, and I think everyone. He's got a great feel about it, and I really wanted to ask him how he really does balance that. How he gets in there, how he's able to keep that good relationship with us, but the professionalism of his job. So, guys, sit back and enjoy this one. This is a real favorite of mine. You're going to have to excuse the audio. I made a bit of a boo-boo with the recording on this. I think it's still worth listening to, and I still think it's very good audio quality. So, well, not very good. It's still very listenable. So, without further ado, I bring you Juanma Garate. Manuel Garate, or as I like to call you, Juanma, as everyone likes to call you.
Juanma is better. Juanma. It's more familiar.
You're my sports director at EF Education First. But more than that, I see you as a special sports director, and you're the person I thought of when I wanted to interview a sports director. First of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Yes, you're from the Basque Country in Spain, so that's his accent. He speaks perfect English in my eyes. But you're going to love that Basque accent. Anyway.
You are putting too much pressure on me.
I spoke to Tom Southam a few weeks ago, and I thought he was great to talk about the nitty-gritty of a sports director. What it's like driving the car, what the setup is, all the little bits and pieces. But then I thought, something extra. The job has something extra, and that's what I wanted to speak to you today about. Before we get into that, now, I want to set this up for everyone. Something really special, because I have to set up who you are. I want to take everyone back to 2009, stage 20 of the Tour de France. It's a famous stage. It's the pinnacle stage before they go to the Champs-Élysées, and it's Mont Ventoux hilltop finish. The previous finish to there was back in 2002, so 7 years before, and Richard Virenque won that stage. It only been up the Mont Ventoux finish 8 times before in the history of the Tour de France, so it's very, very special. It's a very hard climb. Juanma was riding for Rabobank at the time, and I'm going to let him tell the story a bit, but I'll just give you a bit of background just to build up what's happening here. Rabobank had a pretty shit tour.
Exactly.
Denis Menchov was their hopes. He was sitting back in 50th. Gesink had crashed out, broken his wrist. So the team, Juanma was a super domestique, a very difficult position, I can imagine. The team had probably asked him, yeah, you've got your opportunity, slip in some brakes, do something. But the morale was gone, the team was lost, it's stage 20, the hardest race, the hardest stage of the tour. And for everyone to cast their minds back to that tour, Alberto Contador and Lance Armstrong were having an internal fight in their team. They were trying to fight each other, more or less. And they were right behind Juanma on this stage. Where I want Juanma to pick up is 16 guys have gone down the road. They start Mont Ventoux with about 5 minutes lead on the peloton. Juanma decides to attack the 16 guys and takes 2 guys with him, Tony Martin and Christophe Riblon. As they come out of the trees for the final 6K to go, pace had been on, and just with the three of them, and there's only 2 guys left. Juanma and Tony Martin. What happened from there, and with that whole build up, take me through the mindset of you leading to this moment.
Once we were in two on the final, on the last kilometers, I look at Tony, and I think he had only one tempo, right? And I tested him a couple of times changing tempo, and I saw him that he couldn't really change tempo, and he had a really high tempo, that's true, because he even put the 53 on on the second part of Mont Ventoux for 1 kilometer, and I was suffering a little bit there. And but honestly, I only had in mind to don't lose the race, because it happened to me 2 years before in San Sebastian, which is the race of my dreams. I'm from País Vasco, as you said, and I grew up going with my sandwich and my backpack up the mountain, up to Jaizkibel, to see the race every year, every summer. So then I became professional, which it was a dream for me, and then I was racing that race, and I rode that race, I won the mountain prime. I was super proud of it. It was kind of a dream. And then I was in a position to win the race in 2007, and I lose it. I arrived with another rider, and I was too enthusiastic in the final, because everything came into my mind, and I did a big mistake in the last 300 meters, and I lost the race. So, and it was something that I couldn't forgot, and I still don't forgot that, right? So I at that moment, at 6 Ks to go or 8 Ks to go on Mont Ventoux, that thing came to my mind. I said, come on, you cannot lose today, right? So second is not enough, especially because I won him at the Vuelta a España one stage and at the Giro two. And you know that sometimes when you have a win at the Tour and at Giro and at the Vuelta, everybody's asking you when is going to come the win at the Tour, right? And it's like, if
I was going to say, when you have two children, everyone's asking when's the third coming.
Yeah, exactly. I have 3 kids, so no. And so I asked myself, don't do mistakes in the final part. That's the only thing I was repeating every time to myself, like, okay, stay cool, stay concentrated until the line, and keep going, right? And it's exactly what I did. I mean, I 1.5 kilometer to go, I hear in the radio that one rider was coming. Was Pelizotti, was coming really close to us, like he was catching us. Said, now if I don't go, it's over. I went 900 meters to go, and we turned left, and it was really a lot of headwind. And I looked back 2 times, and I saw Tony Martin, that he didn't react to my attack. So that means that if you are with another rider and he's not following you, that is because he doesn't have power enough, right? At 900 meters to the finish. And I looked back 2 times, and because he had a high tempo on his legs, he kept me every time at the same distance, because the wind. That's why I decided to stop again. And because I couldn't lose the race. It's like, now you need to be sure that you win. And if you have a rider 30 meters behind you for 700 meters, maybe he's coming double speed in the last 200 meters and you don't see him coming, and then you lose the race. And then I decided to stop again. And because the chaser, Pelizotti, he couldn't make it anymore. That's why I decided, okay, I'm gonna stop. Tony, he thought that I was bad, and he accelerated, and I use him to stay in the wheel until the last corner.
In the headwind.
Yeah. In the headwind, exactly.
This is exactly why I wanted to bring this victory up to you. Apart from the victory, I think this sets up exactly what I want to talk to you about today, and this side of you as a sports director. If anyone can try and put themselves in Juan Mar's shoes, very difficult because not many people have ever been in that situation. There's so much going on, and I try to build up all the extra pressure from the external before the stage. You started then giving us a little insight to your own internal tickings. Okay, I want to do this because I don't want to lose again. San Sebastian, it's Mont Ventoux, first Spanish winner ever. I'm sure all this is subconsciously going in your head. They're coming, Armstrong, Pelizotti, they're 30 seconds behind. But the clarity, the ability to think so clearly in that moment, because 9 times out of 10, a lot of guys would attack and they'd use their bullets. They wouldn't think anymore. Head down, bum up, 900 meters to go, and like you said, if someone's, the rabbit chasing the mouse, maybe it's easier for Tony to get you.
Yeah,
but exactly. That ability to think in that heat of the moment, I think, is what makes a real winner and a real leader. And that's exactly what I wanted you to say. I'm so happy you went down that line, because something really amazing about you, as I've been able to experience as a sport director, as being a receiver of you as a sports director is that ability to connect to riders. And I think this is a really important part of a sports director, and I know you value that very highly, because not that all sports directors don't, but I think you've been able to balance that really intricate sort of balance between too close to a rider and too far away.
That's important.
It's very important. So just one more little background for everyone, just understand Juanmar before, just to get a picture of how he's been able to build up this win. I think is an integral part, but his career is also very integral. 14 years as a pro, 26 grand tours, the Giro being his absolute favorite. Mm-hmm. 8 times doing the Giro, 4 times in the top 10 in GC. He won a stage there, like he said before, but also the mountains jersey, so he's a bit of a climber. He then went and did, you know, the tour 6 times as well, took a stage there, the Mont Ventoux, which we spoke about, 12 times at the Vuelta. We also took a stage and was 15th on GC, which a race you've told me you never really focus on the GC.
Yeah.
Rode with Lamprey from 2000, Sonia Deval 2005, Quickstep 2006 to 2008, Rabo, and then retired in 2000, well, the start of 2014. So a really long career. But I think more important in that career is the time in a Grand Tour, the pressure situations, the dynamics of a team, but also the difference in teams over that span of career. So what I want to ask you today now, I guess, is run me through that 2-year period from retiring to becoming a DS, and then as you became a DS, how did you want to approach this? Is it the way you are now? Is that exactly what you envisioned, or things have developed over the time and you've started getting into that personal relationship more?
To understand that, I need to go back a little bit to my career. So when I became a pro, I became a pro in Italy. So as a neo-professional rider, I was riding in Italy, full of Italian riders around. And I was the last man for Gilberto Simoni to win the Giro d'Italia in 2001, my second professional year. So I had to grow up really fast, because to be a foreign rider in an Italian team, doing the Giro and being the last man for your captain is not easy, and you know how the cycling world works. So I had to develop my mind fast, and I had to grow up fast. And then the year after is when I did fourth in the Giro, and I became a kind of a team leader when it was my third year professional in Italy in an Italian team, when I was from Spain, right? So I had to mature fast. So I was a teammate, I was the last man for a winner of a big tour, then straight after I had to be a captain, a leader in the team. So I did almost everything in 3 years, then I tried again to be on the podium in a big tour. I couldn't, and I couldn't find my real space in cycling until at the end of my career I said okay, helping a big name, helping a big rider to win a big tour, that's my job. And I found my space there. So to do that, I had to develop really good the vision of the race. I had to be a good leader, because I was the road captain, as you are now, Mitch, in the team. So I had a lot of responsibility, not to win the races, but just to help the big leader to win it.
At what point in your career was this? Because, as I said there before, you said you weren't able to go that next step. But for a lot of people, I think they get caught up in, if you're finishing top 10 in Grand Tours, a lot of guys hang on to that, and they hang on to it for the rest of their career and try and always beat that. But you were humble enough to just go, I get it, I'm going to step away, and this is going to make me more happy than keep striving for something I know I can't achieve. When was that in your career?
I mean, when I became to Rabobank.
Yeah.
So after I was in Quickstep, I was still kind of a leader there, some races, especially at the Giro. But because Quickstep is a team that doesn't take care really a lot about big tours, because I saw my limit too, then is when I decided, okay, now I don't feel comfortable with that position, I need to change team and I need to have a different role. Mm-hmm. That's when I decided to change. I developed that part of my personality into the final part of my career. And because the first part of my career, I had to grow up really fast. Both things create a combination that I could read the race really good, especially the last 6 years of my career. When I stopped it, I didn't stop my career in a really good way. I mean, I had a discussion with my last team, and I had to stop and to leave cycling from the back door. And so I disappeared without to say goodbye, right? And it cost me mentally energy, and I couldn't really deal with that, and I need some help to came out of that black hole, right? So this was 2014. I was still a professional rider, but I decided at the end of the year, okay, I can't continue like this. I am gonna stop. So in 2015, at the end of 2014, I decided, okay, I want to know how a DS is prepared, and I am gonna do the courses by my own, because I want to be not ready because I didn't have in mind to come back on cycling, because I was cold. Mentally tired. So I didn't want to be in cycling anymore at that moment. But at the same time, I wanted to know how a DS is prepared. So that's why I decided to do the courses, and I did the national courses, and then I came to Swiss. And I remember that I was the only one in Switzerland doing the course without team. Yeah. I was kind of freelance.
Asking you that? What are you doing?
Yeah.
Are you on a team next year?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Keep saying, no, I'm doing it myself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That question, you know. Look, when you do the inscription to do the course in the UCI, you need to choose if you are independent or you are part of a team. If you are part of the team, the course is shorter. But if you are independent, the course is a kind of 2 weeks. So my cross was, okay, obviously independent, 2 weeks, right? But when they saw my name and they saw that I have done 15 years as a rider, they called me and it's like, I think you don't need to do the long course. I said, yeah, but I am independent, right? So yeah. I did the right description. Right? Yeah. So it's not, yeah, yeah. So they gave me the opportunity to do the short one because they thought that I had some knowledges, right? So that was funny. It was funny because I had the hotel and everything booked for 2 weeks. Yeah. But thanks to the UCI, finally, I can say that one time. So I was ready. I did the courses and I was ready. And Charlie Begelius informed me a week after the course, but he didn't know that I was doing the course.
Did you know Charlie before?
Yeah, as a rider, yes.
Yeah.
We have done a couple of races together. I mean, never.
But like personally, like in the race, would you go, hey, Charlie, catch
yeah,
up?
Yeah, yeah, kind of. We didn't have really a big relation, but because we were doing more or less the same races during the
same
year.
Same job, more or less?
Kind of, yeah. So that's why we knew each other. And he phoned me, and I was not ready to do this, and I said, okay, let me think about it. And at the end, I think I did the right thing, because it was the way to come back on cycling and to be healthy again.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, that's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, interrupting our episode here just to remind us to tell you that Life in the Peloton this week is sponsored by our friends at Beer 52. And well, the summer is giving way to autumn, and so logically cycling is gearing up for the spring classics, as well as the Giro d'Italia and the Vuelta a España. And if you're planning to sit down and watch some of the racing on a weekend afternoon, you may want a nice beer to accompany the cycling. And Beer 52 are offering 8 craft beers sourced and curated from some of the best breweries on the planet for free. All you need to do is pay the £5.95 for postage by going to beer52.com/cycle. Now, Richard, we've enjoyed deliveries from Beer 52 over the past month, haven't we?
Well, for the last couple of years, actually, yes. And as long with your crate of beer that you get every month, you get a magazine, Ferment. And an article in the recent issue of Ferment is by Owen Walsh, a friend of the podcast, who invited us to do an event in Brussels, actually, when the Tour de France started there last year. And he's written a big piece, a really, really good piece about the links between beer and cycling. with an emphasis on Belgium, really. The relationship between beer and cycling in Flanders is more overt, he says, and he goes into a lot of detail about some of the classic races in Belgium, his own experiences watching them, and the links with beer. He talks also about Maize, the alcohol-free lager that sponsor De Koninck Quick Step, and about why they chose cycling as a vehicle for them to promote their beer. So a very interesting piece in Ferment with some lovely images of cycling in there as well by Owen Walsh.
Well, you get a copy of Ferment magazine with each case, as well as a tasty snack. And if you want to change your membership or pause or cancel at any time, you can do so. So if you'd like to get your first case of Beer 52 beers for just the cost of postage, which is £5.95, go to beer52.com/cycle. That's beer52.com/cycle. This episode is also supported by Harry's, Harry's Razors. And Richard, you're a Harry's Razors customer, aren't you?
The only one on the podcast, Lionel, because I'm the only one who uses a razor. Yes. Don't imagine Mitch has much call for a razor either, does he? Maybe to shave around that wonderful moustache of his. But yeah, I've been a Harry's customer for a couple of years since they began advertising in the podcast. Very satisfied as well.
Excellent. Well, Harry's are offering a trial set for just £3.95. And in that trial set, you get the weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover. And if you want to try out Harry's razors, go to harrys.com/cycling now. That's harrys.com/cycling.
I think when you come in, it's very easy to get wrapped up in the situation, and you come in with this idea. Oh, this is what I can imagine. You come in with this idea, you're fresh, I've got these ideas, this is how I want to do it. You really probably looked at a lot of directors that you thought were great, that's what I want to be, guys you didn't like, you don't want to be that. But suddenly you're in this team, there's different dynamics, different pressures. How were those first few years finding your feet but still trying to keep on your own path of what you wanted to be as a director, what you wanted to present, and actually finding out that maybe the things you want to do the team wasn't happy with or didn't want you to do, so you had to alter who you were to ultimately find, you know, shape who you, how you want to be a director. How were those first few years?
Just to make it easy, it's like when you came out of the university and you go to the rear wall to work. And then you start working and you realize that you don't know nothing. Mm. it's sad to say, but it's, as I said, I did 15 years as a rider. One year working for Unipublic, Vuelta a España, as a radio tour. And then I became a DS and I realized that I didn't know anything. Mm. Anything. I mean, I had the license, I did the courses, but you don't know the real life as it is when you came out of the university, right? Mm. So you are not ready for the real life as a DS. So I had to learn from zero all the logistical stuff that it is behind that as a rider you don't know. And you need to understand riders, you need to understand staff, you need to manage a lot of people around you and things that you are not habituated to work with, for example, simple things like Excel, right? Or, I don't know,
managing, I think a big point there, managing staff, being like managing people.
Exactly. So you can have the skills or the personality to deal with people, to be a leader or not. But then you the practical thing, which is just to open a computer and to go into the systems, different systems, to rules, you know, organizers, things that as a rider you don't know, then it's a new world for you. So you need time and you need help to do that.
Tell me a little bit about, taking it back a step now, how times have changed. And if you think about when you were a pro rider, and you've told me a little bit about this, and I want you to explain this to the people, that the life of a pro, when you were a pro, was very different to the life of a pro now. You know, for instance, you know, a good story you say is when we come back, we're very shut off, we concentrate on recovery, you know, every 1%. Give everyone, if you can, explain a little picture of what life was like as a pro when you were coming through, and then what you experience now as a director looking at us as riders.
I remember the riders sitting outside at the corridor at the hotels talking with each other at night after dinner.
Different teams.
With different teams, exactly. Front door of the hotel, like there at, until maybe, I don't know, 11 at night, right? So, and this doesn't happen anymore. Or, for example, as I told you, I think yesterday, like to see the riders going in the afternoon to the mechanics, not only because you have a problem, just because you want to say hello to them or just spend 10 minutes with them, right? So I can see you guys going to them like when you have a problem, especially the new riders, right? Because you have lived the transition in cycling too. And the new riders, they never talk with the mechanics if they don't have a problem. Mm. So because now the new technologies, you have everything in your hands. So with the telephone, you send them a message from your room, and they put you, I don't know, they check your bike with a message, right?
Put the wheels in or whatever.
Whatever. Yeah. It's like, I would like to have a lower profile wheels or higher profile wheels for tomorrow, or please more pressure in my tires or whatever, but you use the messages. Why you don't go there, you see them, and maybe you bring them a couple of beers one afternoon, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to do it every day, but, yeah. But you know, sometimes. So the social distancing that we are having now with the COVID, it is normal in the last years between you guys, but not because the COVID, just because the new technologies you have in your hands.
Yeah.
And it's something that we didn't have it before. For example, for instance, like to phone home, when we were at the races, we had to wait until the cabin was free.
Yeah.
So it was a long line in front of the public telephone to phone home.
And it was a big thing.
Sounds like crazy.
Once a race.
And
yeah.
I am not too old. I mean, only 44, right?
Well, then now explain then, because I think this is something you do very well. This is what I was trying to allude to before. You've been able to cross that bridge between the human element of us riders and staying in touch with us, and then not getting too close to us, but being able to install this level of trust. And I was speaking to Mike Woods today about it, and he said, I was asking him a point. I said, have you ever seen Wama actually angry, pissed off? He said, yeah, I've seen it once in Catalonia. He said, yeah, two guys went up the road. A brake went up the road, 60, 70 guys, and we had our two GC guys in the front, and the rest of the team were in the back. I said, what did you do? You know, I can't even imagine it. Not to say you're a softy, but there's a different element of it. There's, you've been able to create, especially for me, and I guess for Mike, and I think a lot of other guys, this element of, I've let you down. There's not, I'm angry and I'm shouting at you, but like, hey guys, you're better than this. And I expected more. And for me, that's got a lot more weight coming from you, because you're able to, is that something you think about doing, creating with the riders, this relationship?
It is always a different way to approach a problem. My style is, I think I can't have the solution shouting you, even if sometimes looks necessary. But maybe looks necessary because you are angry, and maybe at the moment you should solve the situation, or you think that you solve the situation, but doesn't resolve it in the long term. For me, it's better to try to teach you what is going wrong and how we can do it better. So I have always more a positive style. So I try to look always the solution and not only the problem. And that's my personality. I mean, everyone has his own style. Maybe another one thinks that no, that's not the way. It's better if we push them hard, deep.
Yeah.
And it's like, and that's the solution for somebody else, but it's not for me.
Is that something you experienced as a rider? Because I get the feeling back in your time, there was a lot more direct direction, like, I use the word negative pressure. You do this, or this is going to happen, opposed to, I believe you can do this. Did you experience the type of director you are when you were coming through?
No. But then it depends with which rider you are talking with. Like, for example, I know that Danny Martinez, if I am pissed off with him, because I was pissed off last year at Tour Colombia. He reacted really good, and he said, "I really needed that." So, but you know, you, I use it when I know that he's ready and he's sleeping, but only when he's ready. Mm. Because if I am using when he's not ready, it has the opposite reaction, that I'm pushing more down him. So I need to be sure that he's ready before I push really deep, right? And I was really angry with him. And last year to Colombia, I was also really pissed off one day. And the day after, we almost won the Tour Colombia GC. So it worked, but you cannot use it every day.
That's right, and it also comes that he has to also respect what you're saying. Otherwise, it just, if you use it every day or he doesn't really respect you, it doesn't have the weight of that comment. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not that I am not pissed off. I mean, I have three kids, and you can maybe next time you can ask them, Mitch, and maybe they are gonna see in a different way my personality, because at home, you know, everyone is different. But it's exactly as you said. You need to use it when it's really necessary. Yeah, it's not that I am never pissed off. I am, and sometimes I am. I don't know if you saw Movistar video, and
I only saw a little bit of the documentary. I haven't seen it yet. No.
The documentary. It's fine the way to see the way how the sports director is reacting in the car, and the way how he's talking to the rider in the radio. So he's almost broken the glass of the window of the car, and then he's talking in a different way. So it doesn't mean that we are not pissed off. But everyone has his own style to communicate.
And that's very powerful, to also catch yourself before you grab the microphone and speak. It's almost nice in a way that the microphone isn't direct, because you have that moment to explode, natural reaction in the car, the chimp reaction, just, and then, okay, now I'm going to speak. That wasn't a great move. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was a rider too, and if you hear somebody shouting in the radio, it's easy, you take it out.
Yeah.
And you put it in. And maybe you feel better in the car because you did it, but doesn't have an impact.
No.
Maybe a 5 seconds impact, but that's it.
Let's talk about the preparation as a director, and this is something that I think you do really well. Let's talk specifically about the Vuelta a España. A race I've done with you 2 times, and you spoke a little bit about yesterday, saying it's a nice little touch that I think you have, that I had it when I first started professional, but it doesn't really happen that often now, is a director passes by the room just to sort of say hi, maybe actually check in with someone who needs it, but most of the times literally say hi, pop your head in, maybe chat for 5-10 minutes, and that's it, see someone face to face. But you told me that's only possible if you're prepared. Tell me a little bit about that.
I mean, a big tour needs a lot of preparation. The team we have, right? I don't have a team that I can put 7 riders in the wind all day long to keep the position and to bring our leader every day there protected. I can do it 1, 2, 3 days, but not every day, right? So this means that I need to look for a point in which I need to move my team. I'm gonna use you and in a specific moment to bring my leader at a certain point in a good position, right? So for that, I need to really study really good the parkour and to save your legs as much as I can. In a way that we are not gonna miss the point, still we are gonna be there, but we didn't lose energy before, right? And to do that, you need time. You need to prepare the race. And you need to arrive there to the races with the homework done at home. And I can tell you that I didn't know that this work exists before I became a DS. I still probably not everybody does it, but at the end it's my style, and I like to go to the races with the homeworks done and the logistical stuff prepared. And like this, I have time every day after the stage to go through the rooms and speak with you. I don't do it, as you said, every day, but sometimes I need more time with you because maybe I remember how you were 2 years ago at the Vuelta, when you had to be the road captain, and I put pressure on you, and you had another two riders around you that they also play that role in the races, and they are good also to do that job, and you were feeling, yeah, you needed some help, let's say that like that. So that's why I spent really a lot of time with you, trying to keep you motivated and sure about your job, right? And maybe in the next year, maybe I was not with you as long as I was the year before, right? Because it was maybe not really necessary. So, but for that, anyway, to do it, you need to be ready. You need to be concentrated that the job is done and you have time to do it. Otherwise, you finish the race and you need to go to your room to prepare the day after. And
you lose touch with the riders. And even though you think you're doing, well, this is my opinion, even though you think you're doing the best you can, you know, you're preparing the stage and everything like that, sometimes, as a rider, sometimes it's more important that you're still in touch with the director, the guy who you want to have faith in, more than the course. Because if you listen in the radio or you have that belief of what he's saying, that's more important to me than knowing the course and every corner and every angle of wind, because it goes, sometimes goes in one ear and out the other. But if you tell me something that I really believe, it sinks in. And I think, again, it's a fine balance, because if you disregard the course and just 100% belief, you're also out in the wind as well. So also on that point, you sort of alluded to it there, building a roster. And I think this is something you do really well. I'm not saying all directors don't do this well, but something I've experienced with you is that you start with, you know, your leader, and then you start with the guys to support him. How do you go about building, if you can choose it, it's not always like that, if you can choose your team for a race, is it something you put a lot of effort into and thinking about, or you just have to get the riders you get?
It's complicated. I mean, it is not only one race at the during the year. I mean, at the end, the calendar is full of races, and we have 30 riders, and we need to divide the goals, we need to divide the calendar between the riders and the program. It's not easy, because of course you want to have always the best possible roster in, at every race, but that's not possible. But at the end, depends of how the season, especially at the Vuelta, which is the last big tour of the year. So when you look back and you see how was the Giro, how was the tour, and then you can prepare the final roster, right? For example, this year is going to be different. I mean, our main goal is the Tour de France, and probably this year we are going to use the Vuelta in a different way, like to give the opportunity to the young riders to develop and to learn for the future. So every year is different, but especially, I mean, for example, if it is in a standard year that you go to the Vuelta to try to do a good GC, like for example it was last year, then we had a Rigo, then you start to build up the team around him, like okay, maybe we can't bring a sprinter because the team is, we need some more climbers, then obviously you have to know in advance the parcours of the stages, the profiles, to see if it is really hilly. Obviously you need people that can climb better, but you cannot forget that you need people to work on the flat or to lead the team or with experience to see what is happening in front of the bunch and to give me the information I need. So that's the final combination: road captain, guys with experience, team leader, climbers around him, and then a domestic riders with like we say honest riders that they have full commitment for the leader, right?
And can think for themselves. I think that's a really big, someone that you can delegate a bit of load to, someone that you don't have to continually instruct. You know, you have to go on the break, or do I go on the break? You know, guys who can smell the race themselves a little bit.
But you know what, Mitch? I mean, when you are at DS and you are in front of the riders at the meeting every morning in the bus, and I'm looking to your faces, boys, and I see a guy that is 35 years old that has a lot of experience. But in the other side of the bus, it is one guy that is 22 years old, and he doesn't know how to prepare a rain bag. A rain bag is a bag that we have in the car with clothing when it's raining, and you need, when it's raining, they call the car, the riders, and we give them rain jackets or whatever they need. But this bag has to be ready before the race with the spare shoes inside and things like that, right? So I have riders in front that they don't know if they have a mechanical problem. They need to stop on the right-hand side, on the left-hand side of the road. So can you imagine if I start at the meeting talking about, okay, guys, when you have a mechanical problem, you need to stop on the right-hand side of the bus. So you are going to look at me like, what are you saying?
Stop wasting my time.
Yeah, exactly. But this is the reality. Mm. This is the reality. I mean, sometimes we have riders in front of us that they have a lot of potential. That's why they are professionals. But we need to start our meetings from really low to teach them how it works. And it's difficult, I can tell you.
Yeah, because you would forget. You just continually forget. They don't know that. I even forget that too, just with young guys who come in, or just even, you know, Jimmy Whelan's a great example. He's not, well, he is young too, but he just came into the sport so late that stuff I would have learnt even in club racing, he was still learning. And it's difficult to even take your mind back to that, you know? Hmm. Packing a rain bag for you and for me, it's just like, well, of course I'd do that. But some guys just put an empty bag in there.
I saw some empty bags. Yeah. Sometimes.
And you want them to learn the hard way, but unfortunately sometimes learning the hard way could mean the end of their race. So you sort of have to coach them some of the way. I want you to talk now about, and we started talking about this, this is why I want to talk about Mont Ventoux. This headspace and this crucial thinking in the moment and knowing that moment. And I've done an amazing podcast with Mike Woods after the Vuelta 2 years ago.
Mm.
Stage he won in the Basque Country. For me, I was had nothing to do with that race. I was just in the bunch and I got dropped, but I had my headphone in and I could hear it. And as the story unraveled, and if anyone hasn't heard that podcast, you got to go back and listen to it with Mike Woods, because he explains the story amazingly. And now we're going on the other side, the man in the car. Mama was there behind that, and he was instructing Mike, keeping his head right and just being that level-headed person in that moment, and using some fantastic words to inspire him that he knew he had in his back pocket for the whole race.
Mm.
But he saved
how that. You knew that.
He saved that one comment, which I don't know how you held it, because it would have been 100 times before, to say this one comment. Yeah. that ignited the final bit of juice in Mike's legs at 200 meters to go in the race. So apart from all that, how do you feel the moment, and how are you in those moments? How are you, this is keeping that head, and do you love those moments? Yeah.
That moment, probably it was the highlight of my life as a DS, the highest moment. I mean, I came from Poland and I landed in Bilbao and I took my car and I went, this is a month before the Vuelta or 3 weeks, and I went to that climb to the top, and I went with Borja together.
The bus driver.
We went there and it was a sunshine day, and we went up with the car, and we, as much as I went driving my car to the top, I said, this is for Mike. This is a stage for Mike. And I had that in my
mind. Tell me why, because I don't know, no one's going to know how hard this climb is. How hard is
it? Yeah, it's super hard. It's super, super steep. Hard. And it was a day for the breakaway. Yeah. I was pretty sure that it was a day for the breakaway. And I could imagine Mike not anymore in GC. And I thought that it was a good start for him, because it was a climb in the beginning. And that, I mean, the break was about legs, not about luck, right? To be into the breakaway of the day, sometimes you need luck, sometimes you need legs, good legs. And this day was, to be in the break, you needed good legs, and it was a high quality breakaway. And that was my thoughts 3 weeks before the race. So I was doing the scouting of this climb, and I saw the last straight 200 meters part of the race, and it was super steep, like probably more than 15%. And it was sunshine day, super, super good. So you could see from far away where the finish line should be, right? So 3 weeks later, we were doing that race, and it was good weather. But from halfway of that mountain till the top, you couldn't see anything. It was a fog. That's the
fog. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. It was full. So you couldn't see in front of you more than 30, 40 meters. And I was behind him with a car, and I couldn't see him obviously. But I couldn't even see the TV. So I knew that they were in the last 500 meters of the race, or last kilometer, let's say. And yeah, I remember that one of the last things I said to Mike, and it's like, Mike, count until 10, man, or count until 20, I don't remember, and you are at the finish line. But I didn't know if it was a kind of 200 meters to go or 300 meters to go, right? So he said, it's funny, I think probably he said it, that he counted until 20 and then he couldn't see the finish line and he restarted again from zero, like 1, 2, 3, come on. And then finally he saw the finish line. So
it is, look, we don't need to go into the intricates of the story because it's an amazing story and Mike tells it very, very well in the podcast, so to get the full background of that. But the thing I really like is feeling the moment and coaching it, and 3 weeks before you saw that moment, and that comes from, I think, that time as a pro, all those different positions as a pro, you brought that in to be a DS, but you've been able then to, especially with a guy like Mike, use that to coach him through, and especially on this stage. Has there been other moments like that, or is that something you'd like to think about with different riders, the psychology side of things? Do you think about the psychology side of things?
A lot. With you guys, it's crucial. It's all, I mean, I never did the course, a psychological course, but I'm using every time with you. Every time. I'm you as an athlete, you are thinking all the time how good you are, can I resist, which one is my next race, what is gonna happen with my contract, how is my family at home. Everything is in your head, and it's something that we as a DS is, we need to be really on top of it. So sometimes you guys, you are more open with us and you share more personal information with us because you want, and we can understand you better. And so you are humans, you are athletes, but you are humans too, and you have your own problems at home and in your normal life, right? So to understand you, we need to really come into your head to see how are you thinking every time. And like, for example, now after the lockdown, the situation we have now is that probably you are going to be outside of your house for 3 weeks, 5 weeks, or even more, because you can't come back home and back again into the bubble that we have here now.
Racing bubble, yeah.
Yeah, the racing bubble. So it's really important now to be really, to communicate really a lot with you, and to understand how you are thinking, how do you feel, if you feel comfortable with that situation, because you are coming from a situation that you have been for 3 months, 24 hours a day with your family. Mm. And now you are away for 5 weeks. That's not easy. Mm. Even for us, it's not easy, for the DSS, but our job is to understand that.
Is it easy? I feel like sometimes, even with myself, I would be easy, and even other athletes, because I sort of know what I want to hear, and it seems very obvious. Maybe it might sound very obvious what you're saying. Like, for instance, you see a rider, and in this context, it's going to sound really obvious, but you see a rider, he's walking in, and you say, oh, you're looking good, mate. Looks like you've been training well. You know, you're looking fit. That's it, and walk off. And like that comment there, for a guy, and even for myself, from someone you respect, a DS, a director, you're like, yeah, actually, yeah, it's so simple and it's so vain, but that's sort of what you need as an athlete, that little confidence boost. Are you thinking about those little comments every so often?
You know, mate, as a DS, if I say something to you guys and I am wrong, I'm fucked. Mm. It's not that I can say to you every time I see you, you look fit.
No, of course not, because then it doesn't have any weight either.
Exactly. But it's exactly the same as I said before, when I prepare the races and I am looking for the crucial point of the stage, and I push you to be there at the right moment and in a right position on the right timing. If I am wrong, next time you are not going to do the effort to be there as good, right? So I need to be sure that everything I said to you is, I'm right. I know that I can do mistakes or whatever, but I cannot start losing your confidence on me. So that's why I like to prepare everything really good. Because when I say something, I'm sure that is right. Maybe I can be wrong, but I'm sure myself that I'm doing the right thing. It's exactly the same when I see you and I see you motivated. I'm gonna say to you, you look motivated. Because if I'm just saying to you because I want to keep your moral high, but you inside, you are not motivated, and I'm just saying to you because, not because I'm sure that you are motivated, just because I want to make you happy, I'm doing a mistake because you know that I'm not right. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like, okay, use it as a climb as an example, you know? It's a climb you know I can't get over. It's a 20K climb. And you might say something like, yeah, Mitch, you're going to get over this climb.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what a load of bullshit this is. I'm not going to get over that climb.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, there's a climb of 7K. And it's not right at the finish, but it's important to get over. And it's touch and go if I can get over that. And this is something that helps me a lot. If you go to me and you're thinking, this is something I've experienced on both sides. A director goes to me, he's thinking, I don't know this, but I'm guessing he's thinking, I'm going to negatively motivate this guy. Ah, don't think you're going to get over that, mate. Yeah, don't worry about it. Don't try. And maybe he's had this experience that inside he goes, fuck that guy. I'm going to prove him wrong. I'm going to get over that climb. For me, 9 times out of 10, that doesn't work. I'll believe you and I'll be like, well, Walmart said I'm not going to get over it. Once it gets hard, he didn't think I could do it, yeah. So I'm not going to. Flip side, you go to me in the morning, I think you can do it, mate. It's going to be tough, but I actually think you can make this climb. I don't think a lot of sprinters are going to make it, but I think you're going to make it. When it's getting tough and I want to stop 1K from the top, I'm thinking, he thinks I can do this. He thinks I can do this. And I'm going to push over. So that's for me, is that what you're sort of talking about, that the fine line?
We need to be realistic.
Yeah.
All the time. You cannot lie. You cannot lie. Even it's like when you have a gap of 30 seconds and I say in the radio, okay, 1 minute, it doesn't work, right? I mean, I can say maybe 33 seconds, but not a minute. So I can't lie in a way that I think I am motivating more you, because sometimes you pass the line and it has the opposite effect on you.
What about in reverse to you? What worked for you as a rider?
Yeah.
If you can think back to the directors that worked for you and didn't work for you.
For me, to have the responsibility to see the race, to when I had that pressure, for example, I at the national team, I mean, Spain is a big country and a cycling, and when you are the road captain in a Spanish national team, you have a big responsibility. And I felt really comfortable with that. When the Spanish coach, he came and said, listen, you have the responsibility, you decide, Juanma is gonna decide, whatever he say, we are gonna do that. And I felt good with that responsibility. But at the same time, when the DS is not counting on you, like that you expect something like a more pressure or more goals from the DS in a stage, in a mountain stage, whatever, like, okay, you need to arrive here and you need to do this job and you need to be with your leader until 3Ks to go and then push 1 kilometer hard and that's it. And when you don't have that, then it's like, and now what I do? So what they expect from me? Nothing. They don't consider me anymore. You know, these things came to your mind.
The internal dialogue.
So you need to spend always some words for everyone. Because if you miss one rider, even if I, as a DS, for example, I want to keep you quiet today. I don't want you to have any responsibility. And I want you to save as much as energy as possible because I'm going to use you tomorrow. I need to say that. I must say that to you. In front of the other ones, like, Mitch, this is gonna be your goal. today, take it easy. Tomorrow, we go with you. Like this, today you have a goal. Everyone knows that you have it, and I'm not missing you.
Exactly. When you're not doing anything, when you're sitting in the bunch, not getting bottles, whatever, everyone knows that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And everyone knows, but is it really good for you? Because if I don't say anything, even if at the end, your fatigue is going to be the same, at the end of the stage, if I don't say anything or I said what I said, mentally you feel sure about what you are doing. And I have you ready for the day after. Even that stage, you are going to think about the day after. And you are going to start to work yourself like, wow, today I'm doing nothing. These guys are going up and down with bidons. So tomorrow I can't do a mistake. That's why sometimes the day before, we mention something for the day after. Right? It's like, okay, I know that now is the moment that this guy has to start to think about that uphill final.
Yeah. We could go down a rabbit hole here, but I think you've given us a really good insight to the psychology of a director. And this is exactly what I'm talking to you about. To finish off, run me through what you really love about the job and that moment that you go home, because it's a lot of sacrifice, away from the family and a lot of homework. What's that point that brings you back every year that you've realized over the year, you know what, I really love this job. What is it bringing you back?
First of everything is cycling. I mean, you know what that means, how much we miss it. The race we had a couple of days ago, Strade Bianche, we miss it a lot. And to drive the car behind you without see the car in front of you, have been between the cars a couple of days ago.
It wasn't too bad.
You couldn't see anything, right?
No, nothing.
So the first thing I'm super happy is with that feeling. And the second thing, and I think
just to be involved in the whole atmosphere of everything is something you missed from, like, if you were to stop racing and everything, you miss that, the circus. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, miss it.
Yeah.
You miss it. I have been out for 1 year, as I said before, and I miss it really a lot.
Okay.
And it's something that you have inside. If you are not in, you are missing.
Yeah, okay.
But the most important thing is, for me, is to put on the table the experience I had and I have as a DS now, and I had as a rider before, for the next generations of riders. Mm-hmm. To teach the new guys, or even you guys that you are already in the circus for years, but to give you another perspective of everything, mm-hmm. makes me really happy. But it makes me happy when you have people that want to listen. Mm-hmm. Because I have been in the teams, not as a DS, but yes, as a rider, that they thought that they knew everything. Mm. And I'm super happy that I don't have guys like this in the team. Mm. Guys I have, like, for example, Mike, right? He became professional really late, but he was ready since the minute one to learn everything. So everything I was saying to him, he was just keeping from him. And for me, it was super grateful. Grateful is there, yeah?
Yeah, to, grateful, yeah.
Yeah, to say something to him and to see how he's applying, or how is he using that experience. And then you go back home, it's like, wow, I think we did something really good, you know? And to see how a guy is growing up and you are in contact with, and I mean, everything. Yeah, especially that.
It sounds like it just pushes you to be a better person as in your job, but also you're thinking outside the box because you've got someone else relying on you. When someone listens to you and they take it on, it puts a nice amount of pressure. I better actually say the right thing, you know, I mean, and it's beautiful.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that one as much as I did. I've listened to that one a few times back over, because I just love hearing how he talks about it, how he breaks it all down, the way he deals with us as riders. And I can just see it's a reflection on his own career, the way he was as a rider. I did race against him, but I didn't know him at that point. I would have loved to have ridden in a team with him as a road captain underneath him, just to see that the way that he was on the road. Because he was a bit of a talent himself as a rider, and with that head on him, he would have been a great pro to be around. I hope you really enjoyed that episode. I hope the audio wasn't too bad there and you could get through it and listen to it. Stay tuned. There's some caps coming up. Life in the Peloton has made some more caps. So coming up at the end of this month, we've got some more caps be released. So until then, guys, cheers. You have been listening to Life in the Peloton. The producer of this episode was Will Jones. The music in this episode was composed by Pete Shelley. Thanks, mate.